and our recent victory in Alabama. They know we have a track record, that we can litigate, that we are tenacious. They also know that Quincy did not kill Keith Russo, and they don't like us digging for the truth. They do not want to openly confront us, or frighten, or intimidate, not now anyway, because that would verify their existence, and it would probably require them to commit another crime, something they would like to avoid. A fire, or a bomb, or a bullet could make for a mess and leave clues. The easiest way to stop the investigation is to simply take out Quincy. Order a hit from inside the prison, where they already have friends or know some tough guys who will work cheap for cash or favors. Killings there are so routine anyway. I rarely spend time reviewing the prison records of my clients. Since they are innocent, they tend to behave themselves, avoid gangs and drugs, take whatever educational courses are available, work, read, and help other inmates. Quincy finished high school in Seabrook in 1978, but could not afford college. In prison, he has accumulated over 100 hours of credits. He has no serious disciplinary violations. He helps younger inmates avoid gangs. I can't imagine Quincy making enemies. He lifts weights, has learned karate, and in general can take care of himself. It would require more than one healthy young man to bring him down, and I'll bet he inflicted some damage of his own before he fell. Sitting in Orlando traffic, I call the prison for the fourth time and ask to speak to the warden. There is no way he'll take my call, but I want him to know I'll be there soon enough. I make a dozen calls. Vicky is hounding the hospital for information, of which there is little, and she relays this to me. I call Frankie and tell him to head south. I finally get Quincy's brother Marvis, who is working construction in Miami and can't get away. He is the only relative who cares about Quincy and has visited him regularly for the past 23 years. He is shaken and wants to know who would do this to Quincy. I have no answers. The collar usually works in hospitals, so I put it on in the parking deck. ICU is on the second floor, and I bluff my way past a busy nurse. Two huge young men, one white, the other black, are sitting on stools next to a room with glass walls. They are prison guards and wear the gaudy black and tan uniforms that I've seen around the Garvin Correctional Institute. They are bored and seriously out of place. I decide to be nice and introduce myself as Quincy's lawyer. Not surprisingly, they know virtually nothing. They were not at the scene, did not see the victim until he was in the ambulance, and were ordered to follow the ambulance and make sure the prisoner remains secure. Quincy Miller is certainly secure. He is strapped down to a bed that sits high in the center of the room, surrounded by tubes, monitors, drips, machines. A ventilator hums away as it pumps oxygen through a tracheotomy tube and keeps him alive. His face is covered with thick gauze with tubes poked through it. The white guard is telling me that he has flatlined three times in the past 2 hours. Folks came running from all directions. The black guard confirms this and adds that it's just a matter of time, at least in his opinion. Our small talk quickly runs out of gas. These boys don't know if they're supposed to sleep on the floor, find a motel room, or go back to the prison. The office is closed there, and they can't find their boss. I offer the shrewd observation that the prisoner is going nowhere. One of the doctors happens by and notices my collar. We step away for a quiet word. I try to quickly explain that the patient has no family, that he has been in prison for almost 23 years for someone else's crime, and that as his lawyer, I'm sort of in charge. He's in a hurry and doesn't need all this. He says the patient received multiple injuries, the most serious of which is severe trauma to the brain. Using pentobarbital, they put him in a medically induced coma to relieve pressure on the brain. If he survives, he faces a lot of surgery. The upper left jaw, collarbones, and left shoulder will be rebuilt. Maybe his nose. One knife wound pierced a lung. His right eye could be badly damaged. At this early moment, there is no way to predict the level of permanent brain impairment, though it will probably be substantial, if he makes it. I get the uneducated impression that the doctor is clicking through a mental checklist of Quincy's injuries, and since he'll die anyway, why name them all? I ask about his chances, and the doctor shrugs and says, 1 in 100, like a gambler in Vegas. After dark, my two buddies in uniform have had enough. They are tired of doing nothing, tired of getting in the way, tired of the frowns from the nurses, and tired of guarding a prisoner who couldn't possibly make a run for it. They're also hungry, and judging by their bulging waistlines, their dinner hour is not to be trifled with. I convince them that I plan to spend the night in the visitors' lounge down the hall, and if anything happens to Quincy, I'll call their cell phones. I say goodbye with the promise that their prisoner is locked away for the night. There are no seats or chairs near the beds in ICU. Visitors are not welcome. It's okay to stop by for a look or a word if the loved one is able to talk, but the nurses are fairly aggressive about keeping the place as dark and quiet as possible. I make a nest in the lounge around the corner and try to read. Dinner is machine food, which is seriously underrated. I nap, unload a barrage of emails, read some more. At midnight, I tiptoe back to Quincy's room. His ECG is causing concern, and there is a team around his bed. Could this be the end? In some ways, I hope so. I don't want Quincy to die, but then I don't want him living like a vegetable either. I purge these thoughts and say a prayer for him and his medical team. I back into a corner and watch through the glass wall as heroic doctors and nurses work frantically to save the life of a man Florida tried its best to kill. An innocent man robbed of his freedom by a crooked system. I struggle with my emotions as I ask myself, is Guardian responsible for this? Would Quincy be here if we had declined to take his case? No, he would not. His dream of freedom, as well as our desire to help him, made him a target. I bury my face in my hands and weep. Chapter 31. There are two sofas in the ICU lounge, neither designed to be slept on by an adult. Across the room, one is being used by a mother whose teenage son was gruesomely injured in a motorcycle accident. I have prayed with her twice. The other sofa is where I wrestle with a hard pillow and nap fitfully until about 3 a.m., when I think of something that should have been obvious earlier. I sit up in the dimly lit room and say to myself, "Great dumbass, why have you just now thought of this?" Assuming the attack on Quincy was ordered from someone on the outside, then isn't he in more danger now than he was in prison? Anyone can walk into the hospital, take the elevator to the second floor, breeze past the ICU nurses at the front desk with a plausible story, and gain immediate access to Quincy's room. I calm down and admit my paranoia. There are no assassins on the way because they believe they have already taken care of Quincy, and rightfully so. Sleep is impossible. Around 5:30, a doctor and nurse enter the lounge and huddle with the mother. Her son died 20 minutes ago. Since I am the nearest minister, I get dragged into this drama. They leave me holding her hand and calling relatives. Quincy hangs on. The morning rounds start early, and I meet with another doctor. There is no change and little hope. I explained to him that I think my client could be in danger. He was attacked by some people who obviously want him dead. It wasn't a routine prison brawl, and the hospital needs to know this. I asked him to notify the staff and those in charge of security. He seems to understand, but makes no promises. At 7, I call Susan Ashley of the Central Florida Innocence Project and tell her about Quincy. We brainstorm for half an hour and agree that the FBI should be notified. She knows who to call. We also discussed the strategy of running to federal court and suing Florida and its Department of Corrections. We would seek an immediate injunction ordering the warden at Garvin to investigate the attack and open his files. I call Maisie, and we have a similar conversation. As usual, she's cautious but never shy about filing suit in federal court. An hour later, Maisie, Susan Ashley, and I have a conference call and decide to do nothing for a few hours. All strategies will change if Quincy dies. I'm in the hallway on the phone when a doctor sees me and approaches. I end the call and ask what's going on. He says gravely, "The EEG is showing a steady decrease in brain activity. His heart rate is down, 20 beats a minute. We're getting down to the end and we need someone to talk to." "About pulling the plug?" "That's not really a medical term, but it'll do. You say he has no family?" "He has a brother who's trying to get here. It's his decision, I guess." "Mr. Miller is a ward of the state, correct?" "He's an inmate at a state prison, has been for over 20 years. Please, don't tell me the warden gets to make the decision." "Absent a family member? Yes." "Shit! If the prison gets to pull the plug, then no inmate is safe. Let's wait for the brother, okay?" "I'm hoping he'll be here by noon." "Okay. You may want to think about last rites." "I'm Episcopalian, not Catholic. We don't do last rites." "Well, then do whatever you're supposed to do just before death." "Thanks." As he walks away, I see the same two prison guards emerge from the elevator, and I greet them like old friends. They're back for another day with nothing to do but sit. Yesterday I thought they were totally worthless, but now I'm glad to see them. We need more uniforms around here. I offer to buy them breakfast in the basement cafeteria and suspect they've never declined food. Over waffles and sausage, they manage to laugh about their problems. The warden called them in first thing this morning for an ass chewing. He was angry because they left the prisoner without authority to do so. They are now on 30 days probation with demerits on file. They've heard no gossip about the attack. And as long as they're sitting around the hospital doing little, they will continue to hear nothing. However, the place where Quincy was jumped is known to be one of the few areas of the prison yard unmonitored by surveillance cameras. There have been other assaults there. The black guard, Mosby, says he knew of Quincy many years back before he was assigned to another unit. The white guard, Crabtree, never heard of him. But then, there are almost 2,000 inmates at Garvin. Though they know very little, they are enjoying the importance of being vaguely connected to such an exciting event. I confide in them that I believe the attack was ordered from the outside and that Quincy is now an even easier target. He must be protected. When we return to ICU, there are two uniformed hospital security guards milling about, frowning at everyone as if the president was back there on life support. There are now 4 young men with weapons on duty, and while none of them could sprint to first base without collapsing, their presence is comforting. I chat with a doctor who says nothing has changed, and I leave the hospital before anyone can ask me if Quincy's machines should be turned off. I find a cheap motel, shower, brush my teeth, do a partial change of clothing, then race away toward Garvin. Susan Ashley has been hounding the warden's secretary without success. My plans to barge into his office and demand answers are blocked at the check-in office, where I am denied entry to the prison. I hang around for an hour and threaten everyone who will listen, but it's futile. Prisons are secure for many reasons. Back at the hospital, I chat with a nurse I've been flirting with, and she says his vitals have improved slightly. His brother Marvis can't leave his job in Miami. No one from the prison will take or return calls. For lunch, I flip a coin, and Mosby wins. Crabtree orders a ham on rye and stays behind to protect Quincy. Mosby and I stroll down to the cafeteria and load our trays with leftover lasagna and vegetables straight from the can. There's a crowd, and we squeeze into the last table, one that presses against his stomach. He's only 30, grossly overweight, and I want to ask him how large he plans to be in 10 years, or 20. Does he realize that at the rate he's expanding, he'll be diabetic by the age of 40? But as always, I keep these questions to myself. He is intrigued by our work and keeps looking at the collar. So I regale him with slightly embellished stories of the men we've walked out of prison. I talk about Quincy and make the case for his innocence. Mosby seems to believe me, though he really doesn't care. He's just a kid from the country working for 12 bucks an hour because he needs the job. He hates it. Hates the fact that he works behind fencing and razor wire. Hates the danger of hurting criminals who constantly scheme of ways to escape. Hates the bureaucracy and endless rules. Hates the violence. Hates the warden. Hates the constant stress and pressure. All for 12 bucks an hour. His wife cleans offices while her mother keeps their three kids. Vicky has found three newspaper stories about corrupt guards at Garvin. 2 years ago, 8 were fired for selling drugs, vodka, porn, and the favorite, cell phones. One inmate was caught with 4 phones and was retailing them to his customers. He confessed that his cousin stole them on the outside and bribed a guard to sneak them in. One of the sacked guards was quoted, "We can't live on $12 an hour, so we gotta do something." Over dessert, chocolate pie for him, coffee for me, I say, "Look, Mosby, I've been inside about 100 prisons, so I've learned a few things, and I know that someone saw Quincy get jumped, right?" He nods and says,
"More than likely."
For something really bad, a rape or knifing, you have to find the right guard who'll look the other way, right? He smiles and keeps nodding. I push on. "Last year there were 2 murders at Garvin. Either on your watch?"
"Nope."
"They catch the guys?"
"First one they did. Second guy got his throat cut while he was asleep. Still unsolved. Probably stay that way."
"Look, Mosby, it's important for me to find out who jumped Quincy. You and I know damn well that there's a guard or 2 involved. I'll bet one was looking out during the attack, right?"
"Probably."
He takes a bite of pie and looks away. After he swallows, he says,
"Everything's for sale in prison posts. You know that."
"I want names, Mosby. The names of the men who beat Quincy. How much will it cost?" He leans in lower and tries to adjust his stomach.
"I don't have the names, I swear. So I'll have to get them, and I'll have to pay the guy. He might have to pay another guy. See what I mean? I'd like a few bucks, too."
"Sure. But can I please remind you that we're a nonprofit with no money?"
"You got $5,000?
I frown as if he's asked for a million. But 5 is the right figure. Some of the men in the gossip chain are prisoners who think in terms of the basics. Better food, drugs, a new color television, some condoms, softer toilet paper. Some are guards who need $1,000 for auto repairs." "Maybe," I say. "This needs to happen fast."
"What will you do with the names?"
he asks as he shovels in the last chunk of pie.
Why do you care? It's probably a couple of lifers who'll just get more time.
Probably so,
he says with his mouth full. So we have a deal? You start digging, and I'll find some money.
Deal.
And let's keep it quiet, Mosby. I don't want Crabtree poking around. Besides, he'll probably want some of the fee, right?
Right. Not sure I trust him.
I'm not sure I do either. We return to ICU and give Crabtree his sandwich. He's sitting with an Orlando City policeman, a big talker who tells us that he has been ordered to hang around for a few days. There are plenty of uniforms milling around, and I begin to feel better about Quincy's safety. Chapter 32. 28 hours have passed since the beating, and after 5 or 6 flatlining episodes, Quincy's monitors have begun to stabilize. Though he certainly doesn't know it, there is slightly more activity in his brain, and his heart is a bit stronger. However, this does not inspire optimism among his doctors. I'm sick of the hospital and need to escape, but I can't get too far from the patient. I spend hours on my sofa in the lounge, on the phone, online, anything to kill time. Maisie and I decide to wait another day before contacting the FBI. The federal lawsuit can wait too, though we're having second thoughts about it. There is still no word from the warden, no contact with the prison. Mosby and Crabtree are instructed to leave at 5 p.m. They are replaced by a gray-haired veteran named Holloway, who isn't very friendly. He seems perturbed at being relegated to hallway monitoring and doesn't say much. Whatever, at least we have another armed guard on duty. I'm tired of talking to people anyway. Marvis Miller arrives early in the evening, and I walk him to the room to see his brother. He is immediately emotional, and I back away. He stands at the foot of the bed, afraid to touch anything, and stares at the mountain of gauze that is Quincy's face. A nurse needs some information from him, and I return to the lounge to kill more time. I have dinner with Marvis, my third meal of the day, in the cafeteria. He is 6 years younger than Quincy and has always idolized his big brother. They have 2 sisters, but don't speak to them. The family split after Quincy's conviction when the sisters assumed he was guilty. The jury said so, and they cut all ties. This upset Marvis, who has always believed his brother was framed and who felt strongly that he needed the family's support more than ever. After we choke down the food, we choose to sit and drink coffee rather than to re-enter the stultifying dreariness of the visitor's lounge. I explain my fears about Quincy's safety. I offer my rather speculative theory that the attack was ordered by someone connected to his conviction, someone who's afraid of our investigation. I offer a lame apology for what has happened, but he will have none of it. He is grateful for our efforts and says so repeatedly. He has always dreamed of his big brother walking victoriously out of prison, an innocent man. Marvis is a lot like Quincy, easygoing, likable, believable, a decent man trying to survive a tough life. There are flashes of bitterness at a system that robbed his brother, but there is also a lot of hope that a grievous wrong will someday be made right. Eventually, we drag ourselves upstairs, and I yield my sofa. I go to the motel, shower, and fall asleep. Mosby, meet Frankie Tatum. The rendezvous takes place in a honky-tonk on the outskirts of Deltona, far away from Mosby's world. He says he once frequented the place in his youth, but is sure no one will recognize him now. As always, Frankie scopes it out before they meet. It's almost midnight on a Thursday, and the place is deserted and quiet. It takes a couple of beers for them to relax with each other. Give Frankie 2 beers with a brother in friendly surroundings, and he can be trusted.
I need 6,000 cash, Mosby says.
They're at a table in the rear, near an empty pool table.
The two guys at the bar cannot hear a word.
"We can do that," Frankie says. "What do we get for the money?"
"I have a piece of paper with three names. The first two are convicted killers pulling hard time. Parole is way down the road, if ever. They did the number on Quincy. The third name is the guard who was close by and didn't see a thing. Probably the lookout. There's no video. They picked a spot that is unmonitored. Don't know why Quincy was in the vicinity, because most inmates know better. A guy got raped there 2 months ago. Maybe Quincy figured he was too tough to mess with and just got careless. You'll have to ask him if you get the chance."
"How much do you know about the two thugs?"
"Both are white, tough dudes in a tough gang. The Aryan Deacons. The first name is a guy I used to see every day when I worked his unit. From Dade County, nothing but trouble. The second name is unknown to me. There are 2,000 prisoners at Garvin, and thankfully I don't know them all."
"Any chance it was a gang matter?"
"I doubt it. The gangs are always at war. But Quincy stayed away from them, from what I'm told."
Frankie takes a sip from his bottle and pulls a white envelope from a coat pocket. He places it on the table and says,
"Here's 5,000.
"I said 6,
Mosby says without reaching for the money. From another pocket, Frankie pulls out a roll of bills and keeps it below the table. He counts quickly and hands over 10 $100 bills.
"That's 6.
Mosby gives him the scrap of paper with one hand while taking the cash and the envelope with the other. Frankie unfolds the paper and looks at the three names. Mosby says,
"There's something else. Quincy didn't go down easy. He landed some punches while he was able. The first name there survived with a crushed nose. He was treated at the infirmary this afternoon. Said he got in a fight. Happens all the time and few questions are asked. His face will be messed up for a few days, so I'd move fast. A little confirmation."
"Thanks. Anything else?"
"Yeah. I won't be going back to the hospital. They're alternating guards now, and we're always short-handed. Tell Mr. Post I appreciate the business."
"Will do. And we appreciate it, too."
I give Maisie the first name, Vicky the second, while I pursue all three. 15 minutes after Frankie said goodbye to Mosby, our three computers are raging through the internet. Robert Earl Lane was convicted of first-degree murder for the killing of his girlfriend 17 years ago in Dade County. Prior to that, he served 3 years for assaulting a police officer. John Drummick killed his grandmother for $60 in cash, money he needed to buy crack. He pled guilty in Sarasota in 1998 and avoided a capital trial. Both have been at Garvin Correctional Institute for about 10 years, and since their prison files are confidential, we can't find much. Maisie can usually hack into almost anything, but we decide to avoid breaking the law. Likewise, prison gangs such as the Aryan Deacons are not known to keep much in the way of records, so there is no way to verify their membership. The guard is Adam Stone, white male, 34 years old, resident of a little hick town half an hour from the prison. At 2:15 a.m., Frankie finds Stone's home and calls in the license plate numbers of his car and pickup truck. At 3 a.m., the team at Guardian has a conference call and all info is exchanged. We put together a plan to dig deep into the backgrounds of Lane and Drummick and learn as much as possible about the Aryan Deacons in Florida. Our theory is that the hit on Quincy was ordered and paid for by someone on the outside. Lane and Drummick had nothing to do with the Russo murder. They're just a couple of hard-timers doing the job for a few bucks. The fact that their victim was black made the attack more enjoyable. At 5 a.m., I return to the hospital and find the visitor's lounge empty. I'm stopped at the ICU desk by a nurse, so at least someone is awake. I ask about Marvis Miller, and she nods toward Quincy's room. Marvis is asleep on a rollaway cot, protecting his brother. There are no other guards or cops around. The nurse explains that last night around midnight, Marvis became upset at the lack of vigilance and demanded the cot. Her boss agreed, and they rolled one into Quincy's room. I thank her and ask, how's the patient? She shrugs and says, hanging on. An hour later, Marvis stumbles forth, rubbing his eyes and happy to see me. We find some stale coffee and sit in folding chairs in the hallway, watching the parade of nurses and doctors doing their early rounds. One group motions for us to join them at Quincy's door, and we are informed that his vitals continue to show slight improvement. They plan to keep him in a coma for several more days. Marvis is worried about losing his job and needs to leave. We embrace at the elevator, and I promise to call if there is a change. He promises to return as soon as possible, but he's almost 5 hours away. Two heavily equipped Orlando policemen appear, and I chat them up. They plan to hang around for an hour or so until a prison guard arrives. At 7:30, I get an email from the prison. The warden has a few spare minutes to grant me an audience. I arrive at Garvin 45 minutes before my 10 o'clock appointment. I try to explain to the staff at check-in that I have a meeting with the warden, but I'm treated like every other lawyer there to see a client. Nothing is easy in a prison. Rules are entrenched or they are amended on the fly, whatever it takes to waste more time. I'm finally fetched by a guard in a golf cart, and we go for a spin toward the administration building. The warden is a large black guy with a real swagger. 20 years ago, he played football at Florida State and was drafted into the NFL, where he lasted 10 games before blowing out a knee. His office is adorned with colored photos of him in uniforms and autographed footballs and table lamps made of helmets. Looks like he played for the Packers. He sits behind a massive desk that's covered with files and paperwork, the domain of an important man. To his left stands the prison lawyer, a pale white bureaucrat who holds a notepad and stares at me as if he just might drag me into court for some reason, or no reason at all. I've got about 15 minutes, the warden begins pleasantly. His name is Odell Herman. On the walls, there are at least 3 framed jerseys of different colors with the name Herman across the back. You'd think the guy made the Hall of Fame. Thanks for your time, I reply like a real smartass. I'd like to know what happened to my client, Quincy Miller. We're investigating and can't talk about it yet. Right, Mr. Birch? Mr. Birch offers a lawyerly nod to confirm this. Do you know who attacked him? I ask. We have suspects, but again, I can't talk about it right now. Okay, I'll play along. Without divulging names, do you know who did it? Herman looks at Birch, who shakes his head. No, sir. We don't have that information yet. At this point, the meeting is over. They are covering up and will give me nothing. Okay. Do you know if a guard was involved in the attack in any way? Of course not, Herman says with irritation. How dare I suggest something so outrageous? So, as of today, 3 days after the attack, you don't know who did it, and you claim that no one working for the prison was involved. Is that correct? That's what I said. I abruptly stand and head for the door. There were 2 thugs who attacked my client. The first is Robert Earl Lane. Check him out. Right now his eyes are swollen shut, bluish in color, because his nose was broken by Quincy. Lane was treated at your infirmary a few hours after the assault. We'll subpoena the records, so don't lose them. Herman's mouth opens, but no words escape. Lawyer Birch frowns and looks thoroughly confused. I open the door, pause, and conclude with, "There's more to the story. It will all come out when I bust your ass in federal court." I slam it behind me. Chapter 33. The Orlando office of the FBI is located in a four-level modern building in the suburb of Maitland. Susan Ashley and I arrive early for a 3 o'clock meeting with the powers that be. She has spent the past 2 days making contacts and jockeying for the appointment. She has also sent along a short summary of our file on Quincy Miller. We have no idea which special agent we'll meet, but we are optimistic that we'll find someone willing to listen. Her name is Agnes Knowlton, early 40s and with enough clout to have a nice corner office. Along the way, we pass dozens of agents in cramped cubbyholes, so it's readily apparent that Agent Knowlton has some seniority. In her office, we are joined by Special Agent Lajewski, who looks like he should still be in college. After coffee is served and the pleasantries are finished, I am invited to do the talking. I quickly summarize Guardian's work on behalf of Quincy Miller and give the opinion that he was framed by a drug gang with a lot of help from the ex-sheriff of Ruiz County. Now that we're pushing for post-conviction relief, those responsible for the murder of Keith Russo are feeling the heat. I give the names of Nash Cooley, the drug lawyer in Miami, and Mickey Mercado, one of his henchmen. I speculate that these two, along with other unknowns, are responsible for the rather brilliant idea of ending our investigation by eliminating our client.
"Would that work?" Knowlton asked. "If your client dies, what happens to the case?"
"Yes, it would work," I reply. "Our mission is to get innocent people out of prison. We don't have the time or resources to litigate from the grave." She nods in agreement, and I continue. I describe Quincy and make much of the fact that he was not involved with gang activity. Thus, there should have been no reason for the Aryans to attack him.
"So, we're talking about a contract killing?" she asks.
"Yes, murder for hire, a federal offense." It's obvious, at least to me, that Knowlton is intrigued by the case. Lajewski keeps a poker face but misses nothing. He opens a laptop and starts pecking. I continue, "And we have the names of the two assailants, both convicted murderers. You've heard of the Aryan Deacons?" Knowlton smiles and likes it even more. "A drug gang? A Mexican cartel at that? A crooked sheriff? The murder of a lawyer at his desk? A wrongful conviction? And now, an attempted contract killing to stop an effort at exoneration. Not your everyday case."
"Sure," she says. "But we're too busy putting people in prison to worry about what happens once they get there. Do you plan to give me the names?"
"What will you do with them?" She ponders this as she takes a sip of coffee and glances at Lajewski. He stops pecking and says, "The Aryan Deacons spun off from the Aryan Brotherhood, the largest white prison gang in the U.S. The Deacs' membership is estimated at 10,000, though record-keeping is spotty. Typical gang activity: drugs, food, sex, cell phones. Their alumni, the few who get out, remain members and carry on criminal activity. Pretty nasty bunch of boys."
Knowlton says to me, "Again, we have our hands full on this side of the wall."
I say, "There's also a prison guard who's probably involved. White guy who looked the other way. He could be the weak link because he has more to lose." She says,
"I like the way you think, Post.
We're in the same business, sort of. You solve crimes to lock people up. I solve crimes to get people out." It was a typical work day for Adam Stone. He punched in at 7:59 a.m. and spent 15 minutes at his locker drinking coffee and eating a donut with two other guards. He was in no hurry to report to Unit E for another stressful day of supervising criminals who would kill him if given half a chance. A few of the men he liked, and he enjoyed their banter. Others he despised or even hated, especially the blacks. Stone had been raised in a rough rural area where few blacks lived or felt welcome. His father was a bitter racist who despised all minorities and blamed them for his lack of upward mobility in life. His mother claimed to have been sexually assaulted by a black athlete in high school, though no charges were ever filed. As a child, Adam was taught to avoid blacks when possible and to speak to them only in unpleasant terms. As a prison guard, though, he had no choice. 70% of the population at Garvin was black or brown, as were most of the guards. For the 7 years Adam had worked there, his racism had only deepened. He saw them at their worst. Caged men who had always been discriminated against and abused were in charge of an environment they controlled. Their retribution was often sickening. For protection, the whites needed their own gangs. He secretly admired the Aryans. Outnumbered and constantly threatened, they survived by swearing blood oaths to one another. Their brand of violence was often breathtaking. 3 years earlier, they had attacked two black guards with razor-sharp shanks, then hid the bodies and watched them bleed to death. During the day, Adam made his rounds, escorted prisoners to the infirmary and back, spent an obligatory hour watching surveillance cameras, stretched his 30-minute lunch break into an hour, and punched out at 4:30. 8 hours of work without breaking a sweat at $12 each. He has no way of knowing that agents working for the federal government spent the day digging through his life. Two of them trail him as he leaves the prison. He is driving his pride and joy, a late-model Ram monster truck with oversized tires, black rims, not a speck of dirt anywhere. It is costing him $650 a month with years to go. His wife drives a late-model Toyota sedan at $300 a month. Their home is mortgaged to the tune of $135,000. Their bank records, obtained by warrant, show balances of almost $9,000 in checking and savings. In summary, Adam and his wife, who works as a part-time clerk in an insurance office, are living far above their meager means. He stops for gas at a country store and goes inside to pay. When he returns, two gentlemen in jeans and sneakers are waiting. They quickly give their names, mention the FBI, flash badges, and say they would like to talk. For a tough guy who feels even tougher in his uniform, Adam is weak at the knees. Beads of sweat ripple across his forehead. He follows them a mile to an abandoned school with an empty gravel lot. Under an old oak next to what was once a playground, he leans on the edge of a wooden picnic table and tries to sound relaxed.
"What can I do for you fellers?"
Agent Frost says,
"Just a few questions."
"Go right ahead,"
Adam says with a drippy smile. He wipes his large forehead with the back of a sleeve. Agent Thagard says,
"We know you're a guard at Garvin. Been there for what, 7 years?"
"Yes, sir, something like that."
"You know an inmate by the name of Quincy Miller?"
Adam frowns and looks at the tree limbs as if searching deeply. A shake of the head and a quite unconvincing no.
"Don't believe so. A lot of inmates at Garvin."
Frost asks, "How about Robert Earl Lane and John Drummick? Ever meet those guys?" A quick, cooperative smile, and,
"Sure, they're both in Unit E. That's where I'm stationed for now."
Thagard says,
"Quincy Miller, who's black, was beaten unconscious 3 days ago in the alley between the gym and the shop next to Unit E. He was stabbed at least 3 times and left for dead. You were on duty when the attack occurred. Know anything about it?"
"I may have heard about it."
"How could you not hear about it?" Frost snaps sharply and takes a step closer.
"A lot of fights at Garvin," Adams says defensively.
Thagard asks,
"You didn't see Lane and Drummick attack Quincy Miller?"
"No."
"We have an informant who says you did. Says you were right there. But the reason you didn't see anything was because you didn't want to. Says you were the lookout. Says you're well known as one of the deacon's favorite gophers."
Adam exhales mightily, as if sucker punched in the gut. He wipes his forehead again and tries in vain to smile, as if amused. No way, man, no way! Thagard says, let's cut the bullshit, Adam. We have search warrants, and we have collected all of your financial crap. We know you have $9,000 in the bank, which is quite impressive for a guy making 12 bucks an hour and whose wife makes 10 for part-time work. A guy with two kids, a guy who's never inherited shit from a relative, a guy who spends at least $2,000 a month just on nice wheels and a nice house, not to mention groceries and the phone bills. You're living way above your means, Adam, and we know from our informant that you pick up extra dough running drugs for the deacons. We can prove that in a court tomorrow. They could not, but Adam certainly didn't know the difference. Frost takes the handoff smoothly with, you're going to be indicted, Adam. Federal court. The U.S. attorney in Orlando is working on it now. Grand jury comes in tomorrow. But we're not going after the guards. Most of them peddle goods back and forth, pick up some extra cash. The warden doesn't really care, because he wants his inmates stoned. They behave better when they have trouble walking. You know the drill, Adam. We couldn't care less about the contraband. We're on to something much more important. The attack on Quincy Miller was a contract for hire, a hit ordered by someone on the outside. That makes it a conspiracy, and that makes it federal. Adam's eyes water, and he wipes them with a forearm.
I ain't done nothing. You can't indict me.
Frost says,
gee, we've never heard that before.
Thagard says, the U.S. attorney will grind you to a pulp, Adam. You don't stand a chance. He'll make sure the prison fires you immediately. There goes your salary. There go your bribes, all that cash. Then you'll lose this cute little monster truck with the fat tires and ghetto rims and your house. And shit, Adam, it's gonna be awful. You're full of shit, he says, trying to get tough, but his voice cracks. They almost feel sorry for him. You can't do this. Frost says, oh, we do it all the time, Adam. If you're indicted, it'll take 2 years to get you to trial. More, if the U.S. attorney so chooses. He doesn't care if you're guilty or innocent. He just wants to ruin you if you don't cooperate. Adam's head jerks back as his eyes grow big. Cooperate? Frost and Thagard exchange grave looks as if they're not sure they should proceed. Thagard leans in and says, you're a small fish, Adam. Always have been. Always will be. The U.S. attorney couldn't care less about you and your dipshit little bribery scheme. He wants the deacons, and he wants to know who paid for the hit on Quincy Miller. You play ball with us, we play ball with you.
You want me to snitch?
No. We want you to inform. Big difference. Gather information from your buddies. Pass it along to us. You find out who ordered the hit, and we'll forget about an indictment.
They'll kill me,
he says, and finally burst into tears. He sobs loudly into his hands as Frost and Thagard look around. Cars pass on the county road, but no one bothers to look. After a few minutes, he pulls himself together. Thagard says, they will not kill you, Adam, because they will not know what you're doing. We handle informants all the time. We know the game. Frost says, and if things get too dangerous, Adam, we'll get you out and get you a job in a federal joint. Twice the pay, twice the benefits. Adam looks at them with red eyes and asks,
can we keep this quiet? I mean, no one can know about this. Not even my wife.
With the word we, a deal is struck. Frost says,
of course, Adam. You think we tell folks about our confidential informants? Come on, man. We wrote the book on handling informants.
For a long time, nothing is said as Adam stares at the gravel and occasionally wipes fluids from his face. They watch him and are almost sympathetic. He says,
can I think about this? Give me some time.
No, Frost says.
We don't have time. Things are moving fast, Adam. If Quincy dies, then you'll be on the hook for capital murder, federal style.
What's the charge now?
Attempted murder, conspiracy, 30 years max, and the U.S. attorney will go for every last day of it.
He shakes his head and appears ready for more tears. His voice breaks as he says,
And if I play ball, as you like to say?
No indictment. You walk, Adam. Don't be a fool.
Frost closes the deal with, This is one of those life-altering moments, Adam.
You make the right decision right now, and your life goes on. The bad one, and you're going to be locked up with the same savages you've been guarding.
Adam stands and bends at the waist, belches.
Excuse me,
he says and walks to the edge of the old playground where he begins retching. Frost and Thagard turn and look toward the road. Adam kneels behind a large bush and vomits loudly for a spell. When he's finished, he shuffles back and sits at the picnic table. His shirt is soaked with sweat, and his cheap brown tie is specked with his lunch.
Okay, he says hoarsely. What's the first order of business?
Frost doesn't hesitate.
Do either Lane or Drummock have a cell phone?
I know Drummock does. I took it to him.
Where did you get it?
Adam hesitates before plunging in. When he says what he's about to say, there is no turning back.
There's a man named Mayhall. Don't know his first name. Don't know if Mayhall is real or fake. Don't know where he lives or where he comes from. I see him once or twice a month. He comes here with the goodies for his boys inside Garvin. Cell phones and dope, usually pills and meth, cheap drugs. I take the stuff in and deliver to the right people. He pays me $1,000 a month in cash, plus a little stash of dope to sell on my own. I'm not the only guard who does this. When you earn 12 an hour, it's hard to survive.
Thagard says, We get that. How many Aryan deacons in Garvin?
25 or 30. The Brotherhood has more.
How many guards service the deacons?
I'm the only one I know of. Certain guards take care of certain groups. I doubt if Mayhall would want anyone else involved. He gets what he wants with me.
Has he served time?
I'm sure he has. You can't join the deacons unless you're in prison.
Frost asks, Can you get Drummock's cell phone? Adam shrugs and smiles, as if he's quite clever.
Sure. Cell phones are prized possessions, and sometimes they get stolen. I'll go to Drummock's cell when he's out on the yard and make it look like a theft.
How soon? Thagard asks.
Tomorrow.
Okay, do it. We'll track his calls and we'll give you a replacement.
Frost asks, Will this Mayhall character get suspicious if Drummock finds another phone?
Adam thinks for a moment. Things are still not quite clear. He shakes his head and says,
I doubt it. These guys buy, sell, trade, steal, barter, you name it.
Thagard leans down and sticks out a hand. Okay, Adam. We got a deal, right? Adam reluctantly shakes his hand. Frost says, And your phones are tapped too, Adam. We're monitoring everything, so no stupid moves, okay?
They left him at the picnic table, staring into the distance and wondering how his life could change so fast.
Chapter 34. With the FBI throwing its weight around, Quincy is moved to a corner room that is more secure. Two surveillance cameras are mounted prominently above his door. The hospital staff is on high alert, and its guards are more of a presence. The prison sends one over each day for a few hours of hallway monitoring, and Orlando police officers enjoy stopping by to flirt with the nurses. Quincy's condition improves each day, and we slowly begin to believe that he will not die. I'm on a first-name basis with his doctors and staff by now, and everyone is pulling for my client. He is as secure as possible, so I decide to hit the road. The place is driving me crazy. Who doesn't hate sitting around a hospital? Savannah is 5 hours away, and I've never been so homesick. Somewhere around St. Augustine, Susan Ashley calls with the news that old Judge Jerry Plank has entered an order denying our petition for post-conviction relief. His decision is expected. The surprise is that he woke up long enough to do something. We were anticipating a wait of at least a year, but he disposed of it in 2 months. This is actually good news because it speeds along our appeal to the state Supreme Court. I don't want to pull over and read his opinion. Susan Ashley says it's very brief. A 2-page order in which Plank says we provided no new evidence in spite of the recantations from Zeke Huffey and Carrie Holland. Whatever. We were expecting to lose at the circuit court level. I cuss for a few minutes in traffic, then settle down. There are times, many times, when I despise judges, especially blind ones and old ones and white ones, almost all of whom cut their teeth in prosecutors' offices and have no sympathy for anyone accused of a crime. To them, everybody who is charged is guilty and needs time in jail. The system works beautifully and justice always prevails. When my rant is over, I call Maisie as she's reading the order. We discuss the appeal, and she will drop everything and get it ready. When I arrive at the office late in the afternoon, she has the first draft prepared. We discuss it over coffee with Vicky, and I tell stories about the events in Orlando. Adam Stone made a clean swap with John Drummick's phone. He took the old one as he ransacked the cell and the following day handed a new one to Drummick. The FBI is scrambling to track old calls and listening to the new ones. They are confident that their targets will walk into the trap. They have no information on Mayhall, or at least none they can share with me. But they plan to watch him closely the next time he meets with Adam. For 3 straight days before the attack on Quincy, Drummick called a cell phone in Delray Beach north of Boca Raton. The day after the attack, he made only one call to the same number. However, the trail ended when the number fizzled. It was a burner, a disposable phone with a 30-day plan that was paid for by cash at a Best Buy store. Its owner is being very careful. Adam does not have Mayhall's phone number, has never had it. There is nothing to track until Mayhall calls, and he finally does. The FBI grabs the incoming number from Adam's phone and follows it to another cell phone, also in Delray Beach. The puzzle is coming together. Monitoring the phone signal, the FBI picks up Mayhall's scent as he buzzes along Interstate 95 headed north. The car he's driving is registered to one Skip DeLuca, of Delray Beach. White male, age 51, 4-time felon with manslaughter his worst sin, paroled 3 years earlier from a Florida prison, currently managing a shop selling used motorcycles. DeLuca, a.k.a. Mayhall, arranges to meet Adam after work at a bar in Orange City, 45 minutes from the prison. Adam says they always meet at the same place and have a quick beer as they talk shop. To avoid suspicion, Adam changes into street clothes. His handlers tape a small wire to his chest. He arrives first, selects a table, does a mic check. All bugs are working. An FBI crew is listening in the back of a van parked in the street behind the bar. After a few curt pleasantries, the real conversation begins. DeLuca.
They didn't kill Miller. What happened?
Adam.
Well, several things went wrong. First, Miller knows how to fight and went crazy. Robert Earl Lane has a busted nose. Took a few minutes to subdue him. Too much time. Once they had him down, they couldn't finish him off before another guard saw him. They didn't cut him enough.
DeLuca.
Where were you?
Adam.
I was there, man. Right where I was supposed to be. I know my turf. The ambush worked perfectly, just couldn't get the guy down.
DeLuca.
Well, he ain't dead, and that's a problem. We got paid for a job that's not finished. The gentlemen I'm dealing with are not happy.
Adam.
Not my fault. I did what I was supposed to do. Can't you get him at the hospital?
DeLuca.
Maybe. We've had a look. Lots of uniforms in the way. His condition improves each day, so our end of the deal stinks more and more. We were supposed to take him out, plain and simple. You tell Drummick and Lane that I'm really pissed about their lousy job. They promised me they could do it.
Adam.
How much heat are you taking?
DeLuca.
I'll deal with it.
Their conversation is brief, and when they finish their beers, they step outside. DeLuca hands Adam a brown paper grocery bag with $1,000 in cash, two new cell phones, and a supply of drugs. He leaves without saying goodbye and hurries away. Adam waits until he's out of sight, then tells his handlers DeLuca is gone. He drives around the block and meets them on a side street. Technically, legally, the FBI has the goods for an indictment against DeLuca, Adam, Drummick, and Lane for a contract killing or an attempted one. But the two inmates are already locked up. Adam is too valuable as an informant, and DeLuca can lead them to the real catch. 20 minutes down the road, DeLuca sees blue lights in his mirror. He checks his speedometer and knows damn well he is not violating the law. He is on parole and treasures his freedom. Thus, he sticks to the rules, or at least the rules of the road. A county officer takes his license and registration and spends half an hour calling it in. DeLuca begins to squirm. When the officer returns, he asks rudely, "You been drinking?"
"One beer,"
DeLuca answers truthfully.
"That's what they all say."
Another county car with flashing lights arrives and parks in front of DeLuca's car. Two officers get out and glare at him as if he has just murdered some children. The three huddle and kill more time as DeLuca fumes. Finally, he is ordered out of the car.
"What the hell for?"
he demands as he closes his door. He should not have. Two officers grab him and force him across the hood of his car while another slaps on handcuffs.
"You were swerving recklessly,"
the first officer says.
"The hell I was,"
DeLuca snaps.
"Just shut up."
They search his pockets, take his phone and wallet, and toss him rather roughly into the back seat of the first patrol car. As he is taken away, an officer calls a wrecker, then calls the FBI. At the station, DeLuca is placed in a holding room where he is forced to pose for a mugshot, then left to sit for the next 4 hours. A federal magistrate on standby in Orlando quickly approves two search warrants, one for DeLuca's apartment, the other for his car. FBI agents enter the apartment in Delray Beach and go to work. It is a one-bedroom apartment with sparse, cheap furnishings and no evidence whatsoever of a woman. The kitchen counters are covered with dirty dishes. Laundry is piled in the hallway. The refrigerator has nothing more than beer, water, and cold cuts. The coffee table in the den is littered with hardcore porn magazines. A laptop is found in a tiny office and carried outside to a van where a technician copies the hard drive. Two burners are found, opened, analyzed, tapped, and put back on the desk. Listening devices are hidden throughout the apartment. After 2 hours, the team is finished. And while normally it would be fastidious in rearranging things, DeLuca is such a slob, it would be impossible for him or anyone else to notice that a surveillance team had spent the evening rummaging through his apartment. Another team goes through his car and finds nothing important but another burner. Evidently, DeLuca has no permanent cell phone number. Digging through the cheap phone, The technician hits pay dirt in the contacts file. DeLuca has only 10 numbers in memory, and one is for Mickey Mercado, the operative who showed up in court to eavesdrop on our motion for post-conviction relief. In the recents file, there are 22 incoming and outgoing calls from and to Mercado in the past 2 weeks. A GPS monitor is attached to the inside of his rear bumper so the car cannot escape surveillance. At 10 p.m., the county sheriff enters the holding room and apologizes to DeLuca. He explains that there was a bank robbery near Naples earlier in the day, and the getaway car matched DeLuca's. They suspected him, but now realize they were wrong. He is free to go. DeLuca is not gracious and forgiving, and leaves as quickly as possible. He is suspicious and decides not to return to Delray Beach. He is also wary of using his burner, so he makes no calls. He drives 2 hours to Sarasota and checks into a budget motel. The next morning, the same federal magistrate issues a warrant authorizing the search of the apartment of Mercado and the electronic surveillance of his telephones. Another warrant directs his cell phone provider to open its records. However, before the bugging is complete, DeLuca calls Mercado from a payphone. He is then tracked from Sarasota to Coral Gables, where his trail is picked up by a team of FBI agents. He finally parks at an Afghan kebab restaurant on Dolphin Avenue and goes inside. 15 minutes later, a young female agent saunters inside for a bite and identifies DeLuca eating with Mickey Mercado. DeLuca's chilling comment to Adam that they had had a look at Quincy in the hospital ratchets up the security there. Quincy is moved again to another corner room, and he is never left unwatched. Agent Agnes Knowlton keeps me abreast of these developments, though I do not know everything. I caution her against using our phones, and we use encrypted emails. She is confident that, one, Quincy will be protected, and two, they will soon ensnare Mercado in their conspiracy. One source of concern is that he has dual citizenship and can come and go as he pleases. If he becomes suspicious, he might simply run home and never be seen again. Knowlton believes that nailing Mercado will be our ultimate prize. The conspirators above him, the real criminals, are probably not in the U.S. and virtually immune from prosecution. With the FBI fully on board, and with our client still alive, we can return our attention to exonerating him. Chapter 35. The Sangria is Calling. Glenn Colacurchy is thirsty and wants to meet again at the Bull in Gainesville. After 2 days of trying to rest in Savannah, I head south again and the adventure continues. Quincy has been eased out of his coma and is fairly alert. His vitals improve each day, and his doctors are talking about moving him out of ICU and into a private room where they can begin planning the surgeries to mend his bones. They repeatedly assure me that security is tight, so I'm not compelled to hustle down for more hours of sitting in the hall and staring at my feet. I get to the Bull minutes after 4 p.m., and Glenn's tall glass is already half empty. His large, fleshy nose is turning pink, a shade that almost matches the drink. I order the same and look around for his cute little secretary, who I catch myself thinking about more than I should. I don't see B. Glenn has read about Quincy's problems and wants the inside scoop. Since I've known 100 small-town windbag lawyers like him, I reveal nothing new. As with most prison beatings, details are sparse and sketchy. In a grave conspiratorial whisper, he informs me that the local weekly newspaper in Ruiz County is now following Quincy's case and our efforts to exonerate him. I absorb this in rapt attention and pass on the opportunity to tell him that Vicky is monitoring half the newspapers weekly and daily in the state of Florida. She keeps a running record of every word printed about the case. We live on the internet. Glenn stumbles across it once a week. This meeting has a purpose other than drinking, and after half an hour, I realized that the sangria is the oil of conversation. He smacks his lips, brushes his mouth with a sleeve, and finally gets down to business.
"So, I gotta tell you, Post, I've been thinking about this case night and day. Really into it, you know. This all happened on my watch, back in my glory days when I was in the state senate and also ran the biggest law firm in the county. And, well, you know, I thought I was really in the loop. I figured Fitzner was working both sides of the street, but we stayed in our lanes, if you know what I mean. He ran his show, got his votes. I did the same. When Keith got his head blown off and your boy got convicted for it, well, I was satisfied.